Hello to everybody who's ever had a dog fall in love with them. It's Beautiful Anonymous. It's 1 hour, one phone call, no names, no holds barred.
I'd rather go one-on-one. I think it'll be more fun, and I'll get to know you, and you'll get to know me.
Hi everybody, Chris Gethard here, and welcome to the first episode of Beautiful Anonymous of 2021. And doesn't that feel good to say? 2020's over. And I know not all the problems are over. I know none of the problems are over, really. But mentally, doesn't it just feel good to be out of 2020? Whew, I'm psyched. And I look forward in the coming months as things calm down to not having to mention the grim times on every single episode of the show. And I also, let me say this before, as we kick off the new year. Thank you to everybody who's been demonstrating. There's been this upswell of vocal enthusiasm surrounding the show in the past few weeks. It's been really cool to see. I've been seeing tons of tweets and Instagram tags, and all of a sudden people are really getting vocal again about their love of the show, and it means a lot. Thank you so much. And I tell you what, it's had an effect. We showed up in the New York Times, baby. How about that? The New York Times put out a list of the most comforting podcasts during the current state of the world. And Beautiful Anonymous, number one on that list. Good old beautiful stories from anonymous people in the New York Times. That's always good to be on a list, let alone in a publication of record. It's really cool. Thank you all for being the people who let the world know about the show and make things like that happen. Sincerely, that's got more to do with you and your enthusiasm than it does with me. And I mean that. Okay, this week's episode. We recorded this one a while back, and I have not been able to stop thinking about it. It is, it's a really thoughtful call about what historically has been a very divisive topic. First thing I think we're all going to say is this caller does a remarkable job of just explaining the facts of what happened and the emotions of what happened. Her father opted to leave the world on his own terms. And she had to come to grips with that, figure out if it was appropriate to help, figure out how to help, if so, how to be there, how to experience it. And man, it's an emotional head spin of a call. And like I said, it's a topic that my whole life has been pretty hotly debated. And to hear about someone who was side by side with someone who chose this avenue, I don't even know what to say about it, except that it really got my brain turning in a whole bunch of different directions. Can't wait to see your feedback in the Facebook group, and I hope you get something out of the call.
Thank you for calling Beautiful Anonymous. A beeping noise will indicate when you are on the show with the host.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, is this Chris?
It is. It is. Hello.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing pretty good. Yeah, I think that's the quick and simple answer is pretty good. How about you?
Okay, well, I'm actually doing great. I'm super excited to be talking to you on the phone right now.
I'm excited to be talking to you on the phone.
Yeah.
So what's up?
Well, I thought, you know, so I'm a newcomer to the show. I tried to binge as much as I could this last week. And I just kind of felt like I had some stuff that maybe your callers might want to listen to.
I love that. Welcome to the community. I like that new people are finding it after 4 years. That's pretty cool. And I'm glad we just got the entire back catalog out there for you. That's nice.
Yeah, like I live in South America, so I'm new to podcasts. I only started listening to podcasts about a year ago.
Oh, so, very cool.
So I just came across your podcast. I was looking for a new one, and I came across it, and I started listening to some of the episodes, and it's just fun to listen to because it's just like I love talking to people. I wish I had your job, actually.
Well, I'm glad I get to have it. And let me just ask you quick aside. Would you say the fact that there's so many of them available right now is part of why you got sucked into it?
Well, let's see. Probably, like when I first started, I do a lot of walks in the morning. Like I walk for an hour every day, and I need stuff to listen to. And then once in a while, you know, I just, and so I started asking some of the younger people that I hang out with, you know, what they were listening to, and so that's how I got hooked on podcasts. And then just I've been listening to some of the really real podcasts out there, just like, you know, people interviewing other people, just listening to just random conversations, which I just find fascinating because, as you know, I mean, the more you dig, the more information you get from people that is just incredible. You know, in my job, I tend to talk to people a lot. So and I love digging and finding out really crazy stuff about them.
That's awesome. Maybe some of the people in the corporate chain might hear that the availability of a large back catalog does help people get invested in the show. And I mean, that's neither here nor there. Anyway, that has nothing to do with you. Sorry, I'm being weird. I just don't want my stuff to go back behind the paywall. Anyway, it's not about me.
Sure.
Not about me. So you said you have some stuff you think our listeners might be interested in.
Well, yeah. So three years ago, my dad died, and he chose to die by legalized euthanasia. And I thought that's something that that we might talk about today, just because it's probably not something that too many people have experience with.
Wow. Yeah, that's something that I've heard about for decades and all the controversy surrounding it. Yeah, that's quite a topic right there. That's quite a topic.
Yeah. But so, I had a fantastic experience with it. Like I have nothing but good things to say about it. For me, it was, I'm really, really glad that it exists out there for people.
Wow. Wow. And you said it was legalized euthanasia. So where did this take place?
This took place in Canada. So in Canada, it's been legal as of June, 2016. This happened in August of 2017.
Wow. So this is pretty head spinning stuff. So you said it was a fantastic experience.
Maybe I should give you some backdrop to it. So I mentioned that I live far away. So I was only visiting my father once a year, because that's all the time I really have to, you know, to do a long trip. And in 2016, I had visited him, and I visited him on my own without my family or my husband. And he sat me down and he told me that, in the past year, he had tried to kill himself three times, and none of those three times had it worked. And he was just really done. He was really done with his life. He was 88 when he told me this. And so, of course, for me, I was just like completely floored with this information, just super sad about it. Just thinking, wow, what a bad daughter am I to like not know that my dad had tried to do this three times in the year before, you know? From that moment on, it was just kind of like, okay, you got to put your big girl pants on and you got to support this guy because he's been there for you this whole time. And now this is something that he really wants, and you need to support him on that. So of course, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, okay, boom, everything is positive and we're going to go forward with this. I mean, I had to do a lot of work on myself before I got to that point with him, where I was okay with it. Because I mean, as you know, I had a little pity party for myself, you know. You know, why is he doing this? If I'm still here, if I'm still around and able to come and visit him every year, why doesn't he want to live for that? You know, those sort of questions had come up. But in the end, it was like, okay, you know, he's alone the entire year until you come up to visit. Like my mom had passed away a good 16 years before, and my father is almost 100% blind. So his world is just a little apartment, right? And his audiobooks. So yeah, that's sort of like the preamble to it.
Wow. So I feel like in the discussion surrounding euthanasia that I know, a lot of times it's brought up for someone who has, let's say, like a terminal illness that they're suffering with and they know they can't recover from. It sounds like that was not your father's case. It sounds like he had more, his quality of life was leading to depression, it sounded like. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. And that was one of my biggest questions with my dad. Like in that time in 2016 when he sat me down and told me, you know, how he'd been feeling and everything, I was like, okay, dad, like, so we know that there's euthanasia available. And so we went to his doctor together. We went to his GP, and his doctor was just not on board with this at all. He was just like, I don't even want to talk about it with you guys. I don't, this is, I have a feeling this might affect my practice. So he gave us like a printout of information that he had got off the internet, and he gave it to us, and he was like, don't come back. Like, that's literally, he was like, I don't want to see you again. And I was like, wow, okay. And so I sat down and I started reading through the information. And one of the things it says is that, you know, the person that wants to do this has to be in an advanced state of irreversible decline. So as I'm reading this with my dad, I'm like, I'm looking at him going, that doesn't apply to you, Dad. And then it says the death is in the foreseeable future. And I said, that also doesn't really apply to you, Dad. Like, you could live for 10 more years, you know? And then he started to argue with me, saying, well, you know, the fact that I've tried to kill myself 3 times in the last year, I believe that I deserve to have a dignified death. And, you know, I couldn't agree with him more in that sense. And I said, well, let's see what we can do with this information. And so I had him contact the people that were in charge of euthanasia in our province. And yeah, they came back to him in 2017 after some, I guess, a few little things had changed, and they interviewed him. And then they said, okay, you're eligible for this. And so my dad, I was back down in South America, and he called me and said, hey, listen, I'm eligible for the program. And he was so excited. And I'm like, what program? And he's like, the euthanasia program. And I said, okay. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, this is it. He's going to tell me like what day this is going to happen. And I'm thinking, this was like in early August. And I'm thinking like he was going to tell me October or something like that. And he's like, next Thursday at 7 p.m. And it was, I think it was Friday. And so I was like, oh, okay. Like, wow. Okay. You know, like we're like not even a week. So I had to like just drop everything and get on a plane and go up there. And so I got up there by Monday. So I had 4 days with my dad before he died.
Wow.
So that for me was really precious. Oof.
Now there's a number. Yeah. I mean, there's just so many things to speak about. I mean, okay. First, let me talk about sort of a philosophical thing. Then we'll get into some of the personal things, because that 4 days, it sounds like it must have been life defining for you, I would have to imagine. But first, let me say, it brings up this really fascinating question, right? Where when your dad says, look, I'm not going to live 10 more years because I've tried to kill myself 3 more times and I intend to try again if this isn't something that's allowed.
Right. Yeah.
It's so wild for me because I'm someone who has suffered greatly from depression, and you sit here and I've often said, and many of us do say, you know, mental illness is just as important as your physical illness, and you have to tend to them both equally. And then it brings up this thought that he was certified as having a terminal level of, I don't know if it's mental illness or just, I mean, I guess if he's attempting suicide over and over again, is that ultimately what they said was, okay, this person is intent on doing it. This represents an incurable level of whatever they certified it as, and that is terminal. So we'll move forward.
I think the thing that got him into the program was his COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And he had about 30% left of his lungs because he smoked a pipe his whole life. So I think that was the thing. They were like, okay, so the fact that he's only got 30% of his lungs, that means that his death is in the foreseeable future. And so that was the end.
And do you get the sense that, because you know, your initial reaction was you could live 10 more years. Since that hasn't been brought up before, do you get the sense that the people involved in this conversation sincerely believed that the 30% of the lung issue was a driving factor, or were they trying to help him get where he desired to go ultimately?
I think the second. I think they were trying to get him where he wanted to go, but in a legal way.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like they found the loophole. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And I'm so grateful to them. I am so grateful to them, because it was like, when I finally understood what my dad was going through, like he would sit me down and say, you know, like it takes me 1 hour in the morning to like get out of bed and get my pajamas on and just to like get into the kitchen to like boil the kettle. He's just like, I'm done with that. Like, I'm so over that, you know. And he had no friends left. You know, my dad was a brilliant man. And because he was blind, I mean, his only option was to get these audiobooks. And he had a really good situation. He lived right beside our municipal library, which was a fantastic library. And he had this one woman that would just pick out all these different great audiobooks. He must have listened to like 20 books, like every 2 weeks or so, 10 books a week or something like that. And he was like, there's no books left. Like, I've read everything there is to read. You know, I've listened to every audiobook. I'm just done. And then to be honest with you, when Trump came into power, he was just like, okay, that's it. Like, he was just like, you know, the world is way too crazy. This is just like, it's insane, you know? And I pray all the time. Thank you so much that this happened, because had it happened now with COVID and everything, I would not have been able to get on the plane to go and see him, to be with him. You know, it happened at the perfect time. It really, really did.
Wow. I mean, I do just want to also say that as an American, hearing that the state of American politics was ultimately one of the things that pushed him past a point of hope is like that is.
Well, I mean, it's almost like you can only take so much outrage, right? Like, that's what I'm.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm really sorry to anybody who's listening that is upset that Trump didn't win, but I'm so looking forward to the next 4 years of not waking up and reading the news and being completely outraged.
Yeah, I mean,
how I've been feeling.
And look, the sad part is I think we're all waiting with bated breath to see, does that go away? Because I've said it up and down. There's a lot of news networks. There's a lot of online outlets that make a lot of money off our outrage. So I wonder if they're going to let it go, or if they're going to say, oh, you know what? Our stocks are healthier and healthier because we can get these ratings based on outrage. So I hope it goes away. But yeah, I mean, to hear that your dad was an accomplished person, a brilliant person who's just sitting blind in a room having trouble, you know, hearing that it takes an hour to get from getting out of bed to having a cup of tea, just consuming information.
Yeah.
It does sound like, I hate to say it, but you're describing an experience where it's almost like when I go to see the dentist and they go, oh, you know, we had an emergency, so you're going to have to wait like an hour in the waiting room. And I just sit there dawdling away on my phone. I feel like within an hour or two of having to sit there and be like, oh, I'm just sitting in a room reading stuff, I start to get bored. So.
Right. Yeah.
I can see how he must have felt like he was almost in solitary confinement in a way.
Yeah. And, you know, and the other thing, I remember the other conversation I had with him, and he said, you know, I just get so angry because it costs, like, what did he say it costs? He said, it costs $5,000 a month to keep me alive, like to keep me, like to pay for the apartment, to pay for the food, to pay for the healthcare, you know what I mean? All that kind of stuff. So, and it would make him so angry that he's like, that's $5,000 that I'm taking away from you. You could have that right now, and you could be using it for something, and you're a productive person in society. And he's like, I'm not productive anymore. I don't need to be here anymore. He was from like that sort of thinking, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, I can't tell you, Chris, he was thrilled the day that he died. So the day that he dies, like, imagine for me, like it was like 4 days of counting down, right? Like, I mean, who knows when someone's going to die, except for somebody that's got their loved one on death row. Right. And there's like,
yeah,
I don't know, a time for that. Like, I was like thinking, who knows when this is going to happen? Nobody knows this stuff, right? And so when it came down to when I woke up on the day, it was like, okay, it's the day, right? And it was going to be happening like at 7:30 p.m. or something. And so, and my dad, here's my dad, and he's like, comes out, you know, and he's having breakfast, and he'd be like, last breakfast, and he was like, you know, clapping his hands, and then it was like, you know, he had lunch, last lunch, and he was so into it. And so it was kind of like, I mean, I couldn't help but also be completely thrilled for him. And I was also not going to be the one to be crying the whole day and ruining it for him. Right. So, yeah, I mean, we helped each other that day. We never really talked about it, you know, because we had talked about everything that we needed to talk about the last 3 days. And we had filmed him talking about his early days. He grew up in Argentina. So, we filmed him talking about that, about his childhood and how he hated his mom's cooking and things like that. So we have all kinds of videos of him talking, which is great. But yeah, when the day came, he was really cute about everything. He was just like, that's it. Last time I have to do this dish. Last time I have to brush my teeth, you know, like
he did the dishes.
It was amazing. Well, yeah, he was extremely, extremely independent. Like, we had it set up in the apartment where he knew everywhere. He knew all the steps from place to place.
Yeah.
And he wanted to be able to do that stuff. Imagine if you're not doing anything the whole day. You kind of almost look forward to doing the dishes. It's like, wow, I got something to do.
I do get that part. And I know this is maybe a morbid joke to make, but on this show, I do tend to find them. I have to say, if I knew it was my last day on earth, I would actually be jumping for joy to be like, oh, I get to leave those dishes in the sink. But it sounds like he wanted to go out just saying, let me have one last normal day that fits my routine and then be on my way.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, like he was funny because he was so much older. He was also really old school. Like he would always go to bed early sort of thing. And he was at that point in his life, he was going to bed, like he was retiring to bed at 4 p.m. And I said to him that day, I was like, you are not going to bed at 4 p.m. on your last day. Like, you're having the big sleep at 7:30. Like, you're not, no, you're with us until that time sort of thing. But yeah, I've had to argue with him about it.
I know. Are you an only child?
I am not an only child. Okay. So my brother and I were adopted at birth and lived with our parents. My brother went off the rails in the 80s, tons and tons and tons of drugs. And did you ever see the movie Jungle Fever with Spike Lee?
Yeah.
You remember the drug addict in that movie?
I think
it was Samuel Jackson.
Yes, Samuel Jackson. I do remember that performance.
Yes. There you go. That's my brother.
Wow. So you've lost touch and your father lost touch, I would imagine.
Yeah. So that, and you know, and probably in a really good way because I don't even know if he would have been on board with that, like to have to argue with someone else. Like, but for me, like when I look at this whole situation with the euthanasia, this was 100% my father's choice. Like it has nothing to do with me. You know what I mean? Like I'm his daughter, but like, this is his choice.
Oh man, everybody out there, that makes you think about your parents, that makes you think about your kids, that makes you think about so much. Go ahead and take a break. We'll be right back. Break's over, everybody. Let's get back to the phone call.
For me, like when I look at this whole situation with the euthanasia, this was 100% my father's choice. Like it has nothing to do with me. You know what I mean? Like I'm his daughter, but like this is his choice. And like I know that there's situations where somebody wants to go, and then there's like the children that are like, you know, putting a wrench in the works, saying no, I don't want this to happen. Like I don't agree with that. And so I'm glad that I didn't have to deal with that aspect. Like if there was somebody that was going to oppose that would have been, I think, too much, you know?
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, I'm glad that he wasn't around. He knows. I mean, I did reach out to him in the way that I could, that, you know, to let him know that he had passed and everything, but he wasn't part of it or anything like that.
I have to ask, and I feel like actually you're well within your rights to go, you know what? It's something I just like to keep between he and I. But I would have to imagine that there's a final conversation. There's final words that are said, and you know they are final. Most people don't get that.
Are you talking about me and my dad?
Yeah, yeah.
What were the final words? We had talked so much. And I should say that prior to that, like my whole family, so he died in August, and we had been up for the whole month of June and part of July. So we spent 6 weeks up there. And I had literally just come back from the trip when I got the call saying that he was admitted to the program. So we had spent quite a bit of time together and talked about everything. And when it was finally time, like around 6:45, my dad said, okay, so I'm like, I'm going to go get my pajamas on. I'm going to get in bed and wait sort of thing. And I want you guys to go down to the lobby and wait for the doctor to come. So at that moment, I went into the bedroom with him and I just gave him a really big hug. And I told him how proud I was of him. And I loved him. And those were pretty much our last words together, like in private, other than like, I was with him, you know, right beside him in bed when it happened and everything, holding his hand. And yeah, it was really beautiful.
Wait, so you, just so I'm clear, so you went down, you met the doctor, and then you did come up and you were there, you were with him holding his hand as he passed away?
Yeah, so we went down, and maybe I should point this out. So the doctor that came up, she's a woman doctor, and she actually has MS. And so she's completely confined to a wheelchair now. And so she's actually the one that pushed to get euthanasia into our constitution in Canada, because she at some point does not want to die a terrible death. You know what I mean? So in her future, she wants to die when she's ready to go, because she does not want to die this horrible death from MS. You know what I mean? And so I kind of almost felt like I was in the presence of greatness with her. Like when I met her down in the lobby, you know, she came in, she has like an electric wheelchair and everything. And I was just like, wow, like, thank you so much for all your hard work to push this forward. And then my dad was the same. He just could not stop holding her hand and thanking her. It was really, really, really emotional and really beautiful to see. And so anyway, so she came up, I had, you know, she was like, hey, can you put me into a separate room? I'm going to prepare all the medications. And then, so we did that. And then she came into the room with my father. And of course, there's a few legal things that they have to do. Like you have to make sure that person, she says, are you sure that this is what you want to do? And he says, yes. And then they go forward with it. And there's like basically six gigantic syringes. And then they just, you know, they put the IV in and they start pushing them through. So that's kind of how it went. I don't think that she was in the apartment for more than 30 minutes. Like it was very, very efficient, I have to say.
Wow. And it's with the actual activist that pushed it forward, which must, I mean, like you said, it was meaningful for you. I have to imagine, and meaningful for him. I have to imagine meaningful for her as well. And then, so do you have, I mean, normally if someone passed away at home, you know, someone discovers them, calls the authorities, they send someone to the scene, the body's removed mm-hmm. to a morgue. Do you just have those people standing by?
So this is what she said to me. I was kind of like, you know, cause you know, once my dad passed, she was like, okay, that's it. And, you know, she's packing up, she's getting ready to do that. I'm like, wait a second, hold on a second. You know? And I said, hey, so I know that I'm supposed to call the funeral home now, because she's the doctor. So she signs off on the death certificate right there. Yeah. So that's, you don't need to call the authorities, because basically she's the authority. And then from there, you call the funeral home. And I'm so thankful for this advice that she gave me. She said, listen, if you're ready for him to be taken away now, then go ahead and call the funeral home. Because once you call them, they'll be there within half an hour. It might take 3 hours, but don't call them until you're actually ready for them to come. Mm-hmm. So we waited probably, you know, 2 or 3 hours. We put some music on and some candles, and we hung out with my dad for a while. And then once we were ready, then we called the funeral home and, you know, they come and take him away, which is also crazy in itself, just being, you know, witnessing that, like, that's just not something that I'd ever been part of before. So it was very, I tried to be like, you know, stand outside myself and just be interested as like a bystander, you know, not the emotional part of it. But yeah, I mean, I have nothing but good things to say about the entire process.
And when you say we, so there were other people present.
My husband was there. So here's a funny story. When my dad told me, he was like, okay, so I want you to make sure that you don't tell anybody else. And I want you to just come up on your own. And we're not going to tell anybody. You're not going to tell your friends or anything, because he was really worried that maybe some of his acquaintances or some of my friends' parents might be really weirded out by the whole thing, because it's religious. For religious people, this is not okay mm-hmm. to do euthanasia. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So I was like, okay, wait a second, Dad. Like, I'm going to support you on this 100%. I'm going to come up there and I'm going to be with you and all that stuff. And I said, but once you're gone, I said, who's going to take care of me? You know, like, because I'm not that strong. I said, I need my husband to come out there and be with me and be part of this and be able to take care of me at the end. Because we also had to clear out his apartment within 2 weeks. And I mean, a whole bunch of other stuff that was like super difficult, just, you know, if you're just one person. And so finally he agreed that my husband could come and be part of it. And it was great. I mean, my husband and my dad get along great because they, you know, obviously they're both bilingual, speak Spanish. And so, I mean, it was really, really great. And in the end, my dad was thrilled that he was there. And I'm so glad that he came because literally like for the next 24 hours, 48 hours, it's like, he's there saying, you know, eat this, drink this, smoke this, you know, like he was just helping me along with everything. And like, one of the things that I never realized when somebody dies is all the amount of time that you spend on the phone with relatives, you know, like that's only ate up a couple of days for me. So, and it was just, I wasn't really aware of that part of it, but, yeah, having my husband there was everything to me.
Wow. Do you have kids of your own?
I do. I have two fantastic kids that are, they're essentially adults, but want to hear another funny story? So in March, when COVID starts, because I'm in South America, March is like September for us. Like that's March is when all the kids go back to school, like university and everything after the summer. And March 2020 for my husband and I was, we're empty nesters because our second child was going to university as well. So we were like, just like, this is awesome. Like we've done the work. They're good people. They got into university. They're studying. It's all figured out. And we were, you know, we were going to shut down our business just for a couple of months. And we were heading to Europe to go to the Alps because we haven't seen the Alps. So as you know, COVID. And so we were empty nesters for all of 3 days. It's a sick joke, really.
wow.
So here we are, all four of us in the house again.
Yeah. I have to imagine, because I'm sitting here as you tell your story. And, you know, I do my best to remain judgment-free. And, you know, sometimes with these calls, I find it impossible. But with this one, I'm just really contemplating what you're saying. And I find myself sitting here thinking about my parents. And then I find myself sitting here thinking about my son. And I guess I'm sitting here going, how beautiful would it be to have that sense of peace with my parents before they left? I don't know. And then I think about my son and I go, how amazing would it be to be able to have an opportunity to go, you know, I think there's some opinion or wisdom I've accrued that I haven't really relayed to you yet. Let me make sure you understand this before I go. And then I go, well, and I'm sitting here in my head going, well, why don't I just do those things now? I don't need to think of it in the perspective of death, but I do think also having my son has made me ponder my own death a little bit in a way that's not as scary as it was when I was young. Cause I sit here going, okay, I was 39 when I had him. So realistically, he's going to be in his probably early to mid 30s before he has to start taking care of me, whereas my parents are still taking care of each other because they had me younger. So all these things are arising in my head, and I'm wondering, how has this made you think about your own death? How has this made you think about what you want your death to be for your children?
Well, you know, as soon as it happened, when my dad died, I mean, I looked at my husband and I was like, I want to do this. Like, cause I have an extremely good relationship, a really good marriage. I feel really lucky. And I'm terrified that my husband's going to die first. You know what I mean? I'm like, I don't want that. Jesus God, let me go first. You know what I mean? Don't leave me be the, you know, with everything. And then, I mean, we've also heard of stories where people can do it together. There was a really nice story of a couple that had been married, I don't know, something like 70 years, and they got euthanasia together. They died at the same time. What do I want for my kids? I don't want my kids to have to worry about me or take care of me. For example, my father had everything paid for. Like we had the funeral plot was already organized. The cremation was, everything was paid for. I basically had just to walk in and sign things. Like none of the hard stuff was really, you know, still there for me to deal with. And so I hopefully will do the same for my kids. Like right now I'm trying to like figure out what it's going to be like in 10, 20 years for my kids when they're out adults and they have kids of their own. We don't really know what it's going to be like. I feel like it's like the big unknown now. Is there going to be a COVID-2? Is there going to be a COVID-3? What's going to happen? You know what I mean? Like, so since March, we haven't been working since March. And so my husband built a huge greenhouse so that at least we can make our own food. We have chickens now. You know what I mean? Like things like that. Like, I'm just like, we need to start preparing for a future that we don't really know what it's going to be about. So, I don't know if I answered your question because it's going off on a tangent.
No, me and you just need to philosophize on all this. Cause I hear what you're saying. It's like, I mean, a year and a half ago, I think a lot of us used to go, oh, these doomsday preppers are nuts. And now I think we're all going, yeah, no, what they are is ahead of the curve on the rest of us.
Right.
And then, you know, one thing I wonder if you thought about, because I think there is, and who, I don't know how true this is, you know, you sit here and you go, well, when something like COVID happens and there's millions of people dying, you sit here and you do sometimes have the thought, is this the earth correcting the problem that is us? Because we're abusing the earth.
We're the virus.
Yeah, I mean, right? Like you see floods, you see hurricanes at rates, you see the ice caps melting, you see all sorts of stuff that we cause. And you sit here and you go, is this the earth kind of... Is COVID the antibodies of the earth? Is it the white blood cells of the earth?
Right, yeah.
And then you sit here and you start thinking, like, I feel like another thought that I've heard quite often is people go, you know, if you link up with a partner and there's two of you and you decide to have more than two kids, that ecologically you are putting strain, and you start to think, wow, that is real. This is... science and philosophy and grim, and then it ties back into your story of going, I wonder if there's going to be people seeking euthanasia to go, you know what, I have had my fair share of time, and I want my, like your father, I want you to financially be able to have a security blanket now. I want you to ecologically, I want to feel responsible. It's all, there's all sorts of moral quandaries about the future and about euthanasia, huh? I know I'm just rambling.
Yeah. Now, but... No, but it's true. Like, you know, like in the Netherlands, they're actually right now, they're arguing about whether they're going to have a euthanasia pill. Like you're going to be able to go into the pharmacy with like a prescription and say, yeah, I've been prescribed a euthanasia pill. Thank you very much. Like, and you go home and then that's it. I mean, I can just see all kinds of problems with that situation, but it's super interesting that they're thinking about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you said that was the Netherlands, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the Dutch are way ahead of the curve on legalizing everything, huh?
Yeah, well, okay, so like I told you, I was adopted. I found my birth mother when I was about 21, and she's Canadian, and when I met her, she's like, okay, so your birth father's Dutch, and so I'm half Dutch, and when I was 35, I met my Dutch family and everything, and it's just like, they're so... I feel really proud to be half Dutch, because I feel like Dutch people are, they're super pragmatic. They're very like, oh yeah, you know, like when I saw my birth father and I talked to him on the phone, I was like, yeah, so I think that you're my biological father. And he was like, oh, okay, well, let's go ahead and do a DNA test and before we invest any emotions in this, and then we'll go from there. And I was like, okay, perfect. That sounds great to me. You know, like it was just very like, you know, nobody got their feathers ruffled or anything like that. It was all just like, oh, okay. And then like, as soon as we did the DNA and it was a positive, he called me up and was like, okay, so welcome to the family, you know, and that was it. So it was, they look at things very, very like I feel like they look at things and they don't have a whole lot of emotion into the stuff they're looking at. They're just looking at facts all the time and figuring out how things work. And like, if you ever go to the Netherlands, go to a place called the Water Museum. And they basically tell you how the Dutch people figured out living without sinking into the water sort of thing. And it was just amazing. Like when we went with my kids, the kids were like maybe 10 and 12, and they walked in there, and after they walked out, they were like, they basically understood. There's no questions for the parents about how it works. They understood it all from the museum. So yeah, nothing but good things to say about the Dutch.
Yeah.
Are you still there?
I am. I sometimes do just kind of like take a step back and go, this is why I love that this is my job, because you and I can be talking about euthanasia and how you help walk your father through the process of his own self-selected death. Then we can also talk about how much we admire the pragmatism of the Dutch. Like, those things can come up in the same conversation, and it makes me really thankful that this is my job. I guess, to get back to the real topic at hand, those 4 days, which must have been four truly head-spinning days of your life, were there any moments where you found yourself going, please don't do this, what are we doing here? Or was it just, no, I feel his peace and it gives me peace as well? Because I can't imagine, I sit here and think of my two parents and I go, I can't imagine a situation where I don't have at least a stretch of time where I beg them to reconsider. And it sounds like you had that, but I'm wondering if those last 4 days, how much that reared its head.
So this is what happened. Well, after I told you we were up there 6 weeks with the family. We'd come back from the vacation, and he died on the 17th. So it must've been around the 9th or something. And we decided to call. I was like, let's Skype grandpa, you know? And so my kids and my husband and us, we were sitting there in front of the computer, and we Skyped my dad. And this is when my dad tells me over the phone, oh, I got accepted to the program. And I knew what it meant, and the kids didn't know what it meant. And so immediately I started to cry, and I asked my husband to take the kids to another room, because I hadn't prepared my kids for it. And I was just like, Dad, are you sure that this is what you want to do? Are you 100% sure that this is what you want to do? And he was like, yes, I'm thrilled. I'm just so happy. It's finally going to be over. And so then I just, you know, took a big breath, you know, like I said, put my big girl pants on. And when I got there on the Sunday or the Monday, I don't remember what day it was, I asked him again if this is what he really wanted to do. But I was like, I don't want you to think that, you know, I've moved mountains to come up here and all this stuff. It doesn't matter that I'm here again. If you want to like change your mind, we can do that. Like I 100% just laid it out, but I only said it one time because I could tell that it was stressing him out. Like he had one foot in the grave. Like, let me tell you, like I told you, there were six syringes, right? So the first two syringes, they put them in to relax the body. The second two syringes they put in to stop the breathing, and the last two are to stop the heart. They had put in maybe half of the first syringe, and my dad's eyelids were open, and he never blinked again.
This caller, right, is using words, and we can all see the imagery in our mind. Let's everybody just take a deep breath and think about how we feel about that. Be right back. Everybody, that was the final break, and now we're going to go ahead and get our final words from the caller.
Chris, he had one foot in the grave. Like, let me tell you, like I told you, there were six syringes, right? So the first two syringes, they put them in to relax the body. The second two syringes, they put in to stop the breathing, and the last two are to stop the heart. They had put in maybe half of the first syringe, and my dad's eyelids were open, and he never blinked again from the first syringe. So I don't know how to explain that to you. It was just basically like he was so there, like he was 100% there. You know what I mean? And so as soon as they put something into his body to relax him, like I think my father never even took an aspirin. He's one of those people that never took medication. And so it must have just completely had an effect on him right away. But like I said, he never blinked again. So, I mean, that to me, it was just like he was just, you know, and he just wanted it so bad that I had to 100% be there for him and know that this was the best thing that I could be doing for him. You know, like I don't have any regrets, you know, for being with him and not trying to convince him. But like, let me tell you, Chris, I was part of me was hoping for him to say, like when the doctor said to him, you know, David, are you sure that this is what you want to do? I mean, yeah, I was hoping that he was going to be like, wait a second, maybe like we should think about this. You know, yeah, I was hoping for that, but it didn't happen that way, and that's okay too.
So by the time you did head up there, your kids did know what was happening or no? So they did.
I sat them down and I explained absolutely everything to them. It was, they felt really, really sad because they knew that they weren't going to ever see him again. And I think they were just really sad also for me. You know, they could tell that I was super affected by it. I tried to go outside and do like the heavy crying away from them. And I remember one time on the day that my dad died, I think it must've been after lunch. It was probably like 2:30 or something. And I excused myself and went into the bedroom and I think I stuffed like the pillow in front of it all because I was having a huge panic attack, because it's just like, you're like, okay, 5 hours, 4 hours, 3 hours, 2 hours, and then you're like, it's 30 minutes, it's 5 minutes, things like that. And it's just, it does a number on your head for sure. But I had my husband there and, just holding my hand. So yeah, it was okay.
And, you've underlined so many times and so eloquently that your father, was truly preferred this method of leaving. And it does sound to me like the way you've described it, you said it's fantastic that you want it to happen to you. It does sound like ultimately you're happy that he passed away this way rather than you just getting a random call from, one of his healthcare workers that says we found him on the floor. And it is far more dignified when you think of it from that perspective.
Oh, I mean, 100%, 100%. I can't even imagine, getting that call and saying, he's gone and we need you to come up and deal with this sort of thing. No, I can't even imagine. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. Yeah. I mean, no matter what, no matter what, it's sad, right? No matter what, when somebody that you love leaves the earth, it's super, super sad. And there's no way around it. But I mean, the year after that, I witnessed one of my best friend's husband die of cancer. And like the agony that man went through the last 2 or 3 weeks of his life, there's no way I would want any of my loved ones to go through that. No way.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly, it's really, like not to dwell on it or make it about me in any way, but I'm sitting here going, you're describing something that I can understand the perspective in which it is such a peaceful thing and in many ways a beautiful and dignified thing. And then I also sit here going, man, as someone who has, has tried to harm myself over the years, I sit there and go, what a layered thought. And I find myself stymied. I have found myself in this conversation stymied probably more times throughout the call than I have been in years. Like I've learned how to navigate this show. And I just sit here going, wow, there's just so much to think about. And
if that's something you tried to do that, like I think about those three times that my dad tried to kill himself and he was alone.
Yeah.
And that it just breaks my heart, like to think about that. And he did that really crazy thing. So I asked him, I said, how did you try to kill yourself? Like, what did you do? And the first two times he'd gone to the doctor and told him, made this big lie about how he couldn't sleep at all and that he needed like really strong sleeping pills. And of course, he swallowed the entire bottle of sleeping pills and slept for 3 days and that was it sort of thing. And then I said, okay, so that didn't work. And I said, what did you do the third time? And he's like, oh, okay, so this is interesting. And he says, I was listening to this audiobook the other day and they were talking about, what was it? It was like something in the first century before Christ. There was like, there's some evidence of some soldiers that got really, really sick because the soldiers' horses had eaten a whole bunch of rhododendron leaves or rhododendron flowers. And apparently they're super, super toxic. And my dad remembered that right outside the lobby of his apartment, there's a huge rhododendron tree. And so he told me that he went down there like at dawn one day, and he picked all the buds off the rhododendron tree, and he made a smoothie out of these rhododendron buds and drank the whole thing down. And he was, and then he got violently ill, you know, like, you know, diarrhea, vomiting, fell over, you know, completely. And he was, and then he was by himself when that all happened. And he said it took him about 24 hours to get off the floor. So, I mean, I'm like, okay, well, you know, you're an intelligent man. Like, we don't need to be doing that kind of stuff again. You know what I mean? Like, that's
absolutely. So, I mean, that must be so heartbreaking as a daughter to hear about your blind 88-year-old father picking buds off a tree out of desperation and mixing them up in a that must be the story or one of the things he tells you where you go, okay, let's seriously consider what you're asking, because I just can't have, you can't have that. You can't have that.
Yeah, I was like, okay, Dad, like, we need to, you know, and it was like, I made him promise me, because he lived high up in an apartment, you know, on the 10th floor. I was like, you need to promise me that you are not going to throw yourself off this balcony, that you're not going to, like, walk down the street somehow and throw yourself in front of the train. I was like, you do not put other people, you know, in danger because of what you're going to do. Like, you always, I said, you have to think about the person that's going to find you. And so he did promise me that. He's like, I won't do anything like that where I'm going to involve somebody else that could possibly, you know, traumatize them for life, sort of thing. But yeah, so I mean, nothing, but I mean, it was so great that it happened as quickly as it did. You know, I mean, it was terrifying for me because I really thought that I had more time. But you know, looking back on everything, and now that we've got COVID and all this stuff, no, I mean, it was the perfect time for sure.
I wonder, I find myself sitting here going, wow, I wonder what people are going to think when they hear this episode, because there's going to be such a wide range of reactions, right? There's some people who are going to be sitting there cheering and going, this is exactly why I believe that this is something that should not be stigmatized. And there's going to be some people going, well, human life has value no matter what, and there had to have been a way to improve that life and everything in between. So I guess I'm sitting here wondering about it. And Meg, I guess maybe the best way to explore those reactions is to think about what have people said to you in your life when they find out that this happened?
Well, you know, using one of your words, they're stymied. Like, people are just like, they're just like, whoa. Like, it kind of stops them in their tracks. They don't know what to think because, I don't know. I mean, okay, when I came back, one of my friends, I'll put that in quotation marks. I had told her about the experience, and she was like, wow, your dad really took the unnatural route. That is such an unnatural way to go. Like, wow. He basically cheated is what she was saying, you know? And I was like, at that moment, it was just a little bit too raw for me, everything that had just happened. And I felt like that was an incredibly insensitive thing to say. Like, I felt a little bit angry. Like, it was just like, well, natural, unnatural, I don't know, who cares, right? Like, I mean, this is what he wanted. It was his life, you know? I mean, I don't know. I maybe I was just a little bit too, I could have been a little just super sensitive at that moment, but I didn't feel like that was like a fair thing to say. Do you know what I mean?
I feel like only a Canadian would find a way to go, you know, maybe I was just being too sensitive about other people's opinions on my father's death. Only a Canadian could find that caveat within the middle of that sentence. No, I totally get it.
Yeah, you know,
so you,
it's like, you know, like, I've had people say like things to me like, oh, so you're adopted? Wow. You met your birth mother? Like, wow. I can't even, like, what did you say to her? And I'm like, thank you. You know, like, thank you for having me inside your belly for 10 months and selflessly giving me away to a family that could provide better for me. You know, and like, you know, and some of the opinions are like, I think that your mother is really selfish for doing that. And it's just like, don't remember asking me what you thought. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. I really have always thought, I when I was in high school, when I was entering my freshman year, there was a kid who was a year older than me, and he took his own life. And I remember, and obviously this is a very different situation. This was a, I believe, 15-year-old boy. So obviously I don't think anyone would say it's the same situation you've described with your dad. But the reason I bring it up is I remember being so furious, and I'm still so furious, that his parents wanted to name a scholarship after him and the school wouldn't allow it. And they were hoping that his yearbook for his graduating class would include his picture. And again, they wouldn't allow it. And they said they didn't want to, glorify it somehow or encourage copycats or feel like people would get positive attention for taking their lives. And while I do understand that perspective, I also remember being so profoundly struck by this feeling of, it feels like this boy is being judged for the way he died. And
yeah,
ever since that, I've just always felt like that's just, I just think that's a great wrong to judge someone for how they die. It happens to people who get addicted to drugs, right? You can feel people's judgment of that. It happens with suicide. You can feel people's judgment of that. And I think that to hear that someone called your dad's death unnatural, I understand why that sent you to a place of anger, because it comes from a place of judgment, right? And I just feel like that's one of the things that should be out of bounds, no matter how someone dies. When someone leaves the earth, I feel like you can ponder it, you can explore it, you can ask questions about it, I'm sure, in your case. It sounds like you have no problems discussing the topic with people, but to judge someone for how they died is, to me, just leave it out of bounds. Just leave it out of your heart, you know?
Yeah, agreed. I think that's totally something that, it has... Why? You know, like, what's the purpose of it? What's the purpose of being judgmental about something like that? Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think it just ends up hurting a lot of people.
Yeah. It's because I'm telling you, even I'm not sure what to think. But we're still able to discuss this for 53 minutes now, judgment-free, because I'm sitting here going, I have always believed, ever since you heard stories about Jack Kevorkian back in the day, you sit here going,
right,
if someone has terminal cancer, and like you said, you saw a friend who just, there's people who spend years of their lives in immense pain with compromised quality of life. And I've always said, seems to me like people should be able to choose at that point when it's time to go. I've always thought about, if I'm ever in a situation where, you know, it's, do we pull the plug or not? Because this person's effectively, you know, they're living, but only in the sense that there's a heartbeat and breath. I've always said, well, please pull the plug. That's not what I want. But I've never considered euthanasia for someone who effectively at the end of the day was just kind of just exasperated by life and sort of tired of maybe the loneliness of being, of having your spouse pass away, and just kind of done with it. I've never thought about that. Even I'm not sure what to think, but I'm never going to judge it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, I think there's no case that's the same as another, like every single case is different. Right. And I think at the end of the day, somebody just needs to, like with me, he knew that I'm the type of person that will listen. I'm a really good listener. And he knew that I would sit down and I would give him that. Like, I would listen to exactly what he was telling me and what he was trying to say. I only feel bad because I think he was trying to tell me years before, and I just wasn't really paying attention somehow, you know? And when I look back on that whole situation, it makes me a little bit sad that perhaps I could have maybe spared him a year of loneliness and maybe gotten him through a year before had I really picked up on the signals. But I think I was just really busy with my life and my kids, and as we do, you know what I mean? And I'm not there for the day to day. Like, I mean, my dad and I would talk every Sunday, and I would, you know, I'd come up once a year to visit. And I know that probably wasn't enough. And maybe I should have been going up more than that, but that's just not the way it worked out. You know, I live really far away. It's like almost, if I can get to Canada from here in 24 hours, that's actually really good. It's more like 36 hours it would take me to travel.
Wow. Where'd you wind up in South America?
Yeah, it was a big deal. I'm in Chile. I'm in a small town in the south of Chile. So,
oh,
Chile. We've got COVID, we've got earthquakes, we've got volcanic eruptions, we've got all kinds of stuff.
But listen, I had a friend of mine get married in Chile, and I am in love with that country. They got married in Zapallar. Absolutely beautiful.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely beautiful. Valparaiso, beautiful. Santiago, beautiful. There was, people don't realize, tell me if this is, I believe the truth behind it. There's just free roaming dogs all over Chile, and people kind of treat them like squirrels because what I hear is that there's never been rabies. Like, so you don't have to fear these dogs. And
that's not true.
Okay. That's good to know. Good to know people have their eyes.
I'll tell you why there's so many packs of dogs are everywhere is because essentially people just don't fix their animal. They don't have money for that. And so, yeah, in the little town that I live in, there's like a pack of like 11 of these. You got to stay away from them because sometimes they're not super friendly. But yeah, big packs of dogs everywhere all over Chile. That's the one thing that foreigners take away from our country. It's quite funny.
Yeah, the dogs are there. A dog fell in love with my wife. There was this, my wife went out for a run along the beach and this dog started following her. And on her way home, my wife bought some bologna and fed the dog. And then we woke up the next day and we were leaving Zapallar at that point. And the dog was sitting outside of our hotel in the rain. And when my wife emerged, the dog flipped out. And then when we went to put our bags in the car, the dog jumped into the car. And we had to remove the dog. And my wife, of course, bursts out crying. She had named the dog Curly Dog because it had curly black hair. And then when we drove away, it chased us up the streets. And when we got to the highway, it was running down the highway after us. And I mean, my wife was crying. We still, if I bring up Curly Dog, if Curly Dog gets brought up, she starts crying, saying that was my dog. But then you think, are we going to move a Chilean dog who's used to total freedom in a beach town to a one-bedroom apartment in Queens? That dog would have nothing but regret. Nothing but regret. And
right.
I'll tell you what, and I know I'm rambling and making about me. I feel bad, but you'll appreciate this as well. So
no, don't worry.
The big choice, because Chile is such a long and narrow country, is for tourists, right? You start in Santiago, Valparaiso, and then you decide, are you going to go north or are you going to go south? You generally aren't going to do both.
Right.
And south is Patagonia and the lakes and all that. We decided to go north, and I'll tell you, we said, you know what? We could just fly up at Calama, right? Is that the mining town up north?
Yeah, that's where Chiquimara is. You went up there to San Pedro?
Well, we went to San Pedro de Atacama, which is one of the most magical places on planet Earth. Magic.
Absolutely. Yeah, I honeymooned there.
Oh my goodness. You are in the middle of a desert and then all of a sudden it's like, drop a town that feels like a fantasy town of what you want South America to be. Multiply it by Williamsburg before Williamsburg was cliche. Fill it with the best food you've ever had and just hang out with the nicest people you ever met. But here's what you'll laugh at. We were in Zapallar going to San Pedro de Atacama and we said, you know what, let's not fly up to Calama. Let's just make a road trip out of it, which wound up being bad idea. Bad idea. driving through a desert on highways where we quickly realized the only reason people are on these highways is for commercial trucking. This is the only reason people take these highways. This is not sightseeing. That was a long and hard trip that at points was scary, but I have to tell you, Chile has a piece of my heart, and San Pedro de Atacama in particular.
Oh, wow.
Oh my God, what a beautiful
place. Well, Chris, if you ever come back, you need to come to the south. We'll take you up an active volcano.
Oh, I love it. And we've talked about it. We've talked about it. Well, it's funny. We only have 40 seconds left, so I'll never really know the story.
That's crazy.
How you got down to Chile from Canada. But I do just want to say thank you for sharing, because this is a divisive topic. And a topic we've all heard about, and to hear you break it down so eloquently about how peaceful and how, you know, you give it a glowing review as far as a life experience, eye-opening and fascinating, and I can't thank you enough for sharing it.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, Chris. I was absolutely thrilled that I was able to get online with you today. And I really hope that people take something positive out of this conversation.
Absolutely. So much love to you and your family, and wishing nothing but love and peace to your father And please enjoy the wonderful country you live in, because, oh my God, although I've never been more scared than when I was on one of those funiculars. People are like, oh yeah, this is a weird elevator up the side of a mountain that's been here since 1880. And I'm going, well, how often do they service it? Because it's making weird clunking sounds. But everything.
Never been serviced. Guaranteed.
Oh my God, it's beautiful. Beautiful place. And I hope you and your family enjoy it.
Well, thank you so much. Have a great day, Chris.
You too. Caller, thank you again. This one was just so eye-opening, so thought-provoking. And I say that personally, and I'm sure everyone out there is going to agree. And in the comments, I'm sure you're going to see such a range of reactions. And man, what an amazing call. And hey, if you ever get back to San Pedro de Atacama, have a slice of tres leches cake for me, because the best dessert I ever had was that. Thank you to Anita Flores in the booth. Thank you to Jared O'Connell. Thank you to Shell Shag for the music. Thank you to Jordan Allen for all your help. ChrisGeth.com if you want to know more about me. If you're on Apple Podcasts, subscribe. If you're on Spotify, follow. If you're on Stitcher, favorite. It really helps when you do. Check out our whole back catalog ad-free at StitcherPremium.com/stories. Thank you so much for listening.